I'd like to think I'm the sort of wife who wouldn't be bothered by the croissant, or at least that Simon is the sort of husband who would hide the crumbs. I do submit a PG-rated birth plan, stating that under no circumstances should Simon be permitted to cut the umbilical cord. But since I tend to scream when I get my legs waxed, I don't think I'm a great candidate for natural childbirth. I suspect I'll have trouble viewing the pain as a cultural construct. I'm more concerned about getting to the hospital in time. Following a friend's advice, I've registered to give birth at a hospital all the way across town. If the baby makes a break for it during rush hour, there could be trouble. And that's if I can get a taxi. The rumor among Paris's Anglophones, who, being here temporarily, tend not to have cars, is that French taxi drivers refuse to pick up women in labor for fear that they'll end up scraping placenta off their seats. A backseat delivery wouldn't be ideal for other reasons. Simon is too spooked to even read the instructions for emergency home deliveries in What to Expect. My contractions begin around 8 o'clock at night. That means I can't eat the steaming Thai food we've just picked up. I will fantasize about pad Thai from my hospital bed. But at least the streets are clear. Simon calls a taxi, and I'm quiet while getting in. Let the driver, a mustachioed man in his 50s, try to pry me out. I needn't have worried. As soon as we're on the road and he hears my yelps from the back seat, the driver becomes ecstatic. He says he's been waiting his whole career as a chauffeur for this cinematic event. As we cross Paris in the dark, I open my seatbelt and slide to the floor of the taxi, moaning from the mounting pain. This is no leg wax. I ditch my faux fantasies of a natural childbirth. Simon opens the windows, either to give me some air or to cover the sounds I'm making. Meanwhile, the driver speeds up. I can see the street lamps zipping past overhead. He begins loudly reciting the story of his own son's birth 25 years earlier. "Slower, please," I plead from the floor between contractions. Simon is silent and pale, staring straight ahead. "What are you thinking about?" I ask him.
"Dutch football," he says.
When we arrive at the hospital, the driver pulls up at the emergency entrance, jumps out of the car, and sprints inside. It seems he's expecting to join us for the birth. Moments later, he's back, sweaty and panting.
"They're expecting you!" he shouts.
I lurch into the building, leaving Simon to pay the fare and persuade the driver to leave. The moment I see a midwife, I declare in my clearest French,
"Je voudrais une péridurale."
I would like an epidural. If I'd had a wad of cash, I would have waved it at her. It turns out that despite the French passion for epidurals, they don't just perform them on demand. The midwife takes me into an examining room to check my cervix, then looks up at me with a bemused smile. I'm barely 3 centimeters dilated, out of a possible 10. Women don't usually ask for epidurals this early on, she says. She won't summon the anesthetist from his pad Thai for this. She does put on the most soothing music I've ever heard, a sort of Tibetan lullaby, and rigs me up to a drip that softens the pain. Eventually, exhausted, I fall asleep. I'll spare you the details of my very medicated, very pleasant birth. Thanks to the epidural, pushing the baby out has the precision and intensity of a yoga move, without the discomfort. I'm so focused that I don't even mind when my obstetrician's teenage daughter, who lives around the corner, pops in after the delivery to ask her mom for some cash. As it happens, the anesthesiologist, midwife, and doctor are all women. Simon, stationed far from the business end, is there too. The baby comes out as the sun is rising. I've read that babies look like their fathers when they're born to assure the dads of their paternity and motivate them to go out hunting or investment banking for the family. My first thought when our daughter comes out is that she doesn't merely resemble Simon. She has his face. We cuddle with her for a while. Then they dress her in a chicly understated French outfit supplied by the hospital, complete with an écru-colored beanie on her head. We do give her a proper name, but thanks to the hat, we mostly just call her Bean. I stay in the hospital for 6 days, which is standard French practice. I see no reason to leave. There's fresh baked bread with every meal,
no need to leave for a croissant, and a sun-dappled garden where I steal away for walks. The extensive in-room wine list includes champagne. On day three, I can't stop saying to Bean,
"You weren't born yesterday."
Simon doesn't even pretend this is funny. As if to emphasize that there are universal parenting principles in France, babies born here come with instructions. Each newborn is issued a white soft-cover book called Un carnet de santé, which follows the child until age 18. Doctors record every checkup and vaccination in this book and plot the child's height, weight, and head size. It also has common sense basics on what to feed babies, how to bathe them, when to go for checkups, and how to spot medical problems. The book doesn't prepare me for Bean's transformation. For the first month or so, she continues to look just like Simon, with dark brown eyes and hair. She even has his dimples. If anything's in doubt, it's her maternity. My fair-haired, fair-eyed genes seem to have lost to his swarthy Mediterranean ones in a first-round knockout. But at about 2 months old, Bean has a metamorphosis. Her hair turns blonde, and her brown eyes morph improbably into blue. Our little Mediterranean baby suddenly looks like a Swede. Technically, Bean is American. She can request French citizenship when she's older, but I suspect that her French will surpass mine within a few months. I'm not sure whether we're going to raise a little American girl or a little French one. We might not have a choice. Chapter 3. Doing Her Nights. A few weeks after we bring Bean home, neighbors on our little courtyard begin asking, "Is she doing her nights? Elle fait ses nuits?" This is the first time I hear the French formulation of, "Is she sleeping through the night?" At first, I find it comforting. If they're her nights, then she'll inevitably claim them. Whereas if they're just the nights, she might not. But I soon find the question irritating. Of course she's not doing her nights. She's 2 months old. And then 3 months, and then four. Everyone knows that tiny babies sleep badly. I know a few Americans who, by sheer luck, have babies that age who go down at 9 p.m. and wake up at 7. But most parents I know don't get an uninterrupted night's sleep until their kids are around a year old. Heck, I know 4-year-olds who still wander into their parents' rooms at night. My Anglophone friends and family appreciate this. They tend to ask the more open-ended question, "How is she sleeping?" And even that isn't really a request for information. It's a chance for the exhausted parents to vent. For us, babies are automatically associated with sleep deprivation. A headline in the British Daily Mail declares, "Parents of newborns miss out on 6 months' worth of sleep in their child's first 2 years," citing a study commissioned by a bed company. The article seems credible to readers. "Sadly, this is true," one comments. "Our one-year-old daughter hasn't slept a single night in 12 months, and if we have 4 hours' sleep, it's a good night." A poll by the National Sleep Foundation in the United States found that 46% of toddlers wake up during the night, but just 11% of parents believed that their child had a sleep problem. A toddler's T-shirt I see in Fort Lauderdale says simply, "Party tonight at my crib, 3 a.m. My English-speaking friends tend to view their kids as having unique sleep needs, which they just have to accommodate. I'm walking around Paris with a British friend of mine one day when her toddler son climbs into her arms, reaches under her shirt to clutch her breast, then falls asleep. My friend is clearly embarrassed that I've witnessed this ritual, but she whispers that it's the only way he can nap. She carries him around in this position for the next 45 minutes. Simon and I had, of course, chosen a sleep strategy. Ours was premised on the idea that it's critical to keep a baby awake after she feeds. Once Bean is born, we go to enormous effort to do this. As far as I can tell, it has no effect. Eventually, we ditch this theory and try other ones. We keep Bean in the daylight all day and in the dark at night. We bathe her at the same time each evening and try to stretch out the time between her feeds. For a few days, I eat almost nothing but crackers and brie, after someone tells me that fatty food will thicken my breast milk. A New Yorker who stops by says she read that we should make loud whooshing sounds to mimic the sounds in the womb. We whoosh obediently for hours. Nothing seems to make a difference. At 3 months old, Bean still wakes up several times a night. We have a long ritual in which I nurse her back to sleep, then hold her for 15 more minutes so that she doesn't wake up again when I put her in her bassinet. Simon's forward-looking view of the world suddenly seems like a curse. He's thrown into a nightly depression, convinced that this is going to last forever. Whereas my myopia suddenly looks like a stroke of evolutionary brilliance. I don't think about whether this will last 6 more months, though it will. I just live night to night. What's also consoling is that this is all to be expected. Parents of infants aren't supposed to get any sleep. Almost all the American and British parents I know say that their kids began sleeping through the night at 8 or 9 months, or much later. It was really early, a friend of Simon's from Vermont says, consulting with his wife about when their son's 3 a.m. wake-up stopped. What was it? At 1 year old? Kristen, a British lawyer in Paris, tells me that her 16-month-old sleeps through the night, then adds, Well, when I say sleeps through the night, she gets up twice, but each time only for 5 minutes. I take comfort in hearing about parents who have it worse than we do. They're easy to find. My cousin, who co-sleeps with her 10-month-old, hasn't gone back to her teaching job, in part because she's up feeding the baby much of the night. I frequently phone up to ask, How's he sleeping? The worst story I hear comes from Allison, a friend of a friend in Washington, D.C., whose son is 7 months old. Allison tells me that for the first 6 months of her son's life, she nursed him every 2 hours, around the clock. At 7 months old, he began sleeping 4-hour stretches. Allison, a marketing expert with an Ivy League degree, shrugs off her exhaustion and the fact that her career is on pause. She feels that she has no choice but to cater to her baby's punishing, peculiar sleep schedule. The alternative to all this night waking is supposedly sleep training, in which parents leave their babies alone to cry it out. I read up on this, too. It seems to be for babies who are at least 6 or 7 months old. Allison tells me that she tried this one night but gave up because it felt cruel. Online discussions about sleep training quickly devolve into brawls, in which opponents claim the practice is at best selfish and at worst abusive. Sleep training disgusts me, one mother posts on Babbel.com. Another writes, If you want to sleep through the night, don't have babies. Adopt a 3-year-old or something. Although sleep training sounds awful, Simon and I are theoretically in favor of it. But we're under the impression that Bean is too young for something so militaristic. Like our Anglophone friends and family, we think Bean wakes up at night because she's hungry, or because she needs something from us, or just because that's what babies do. She's very small, so we give in to her. I talk to French parents about sleep, too. Their neighbors, work acquaintances, and friends of friends. They all claim that their own kids began sleeping through the night much earlier. Samia says her daughter, who's now 2, started doing her nights at 6 weeks old. She wrote down the exact date. Stephanie, a skinny tax inspector who lives in our courtyard, looks ashamed when I ask her when her son Nino began doing his nights. Very late, Stephanie says. He started doing his nights in November, so it was 4 months old. For me, it was very late. Some French sleep stories sound too good to be true. Alexandra, who works in a French daycare center and lives in a suburb of Paris, says that both of her daughters began sleeping through the night almost from birth. Already in the maternity ward, they woke up for their bottles around 6 a.m., she says. Many of these French babies are bottle-fed, or they drink a combination of breast milk and formula, but that doesn't seem to make a crucial difference. The French breastfed babies I meet do their nights early on, too. Some French moms tell me they quit breastfeeding when they went back to work at about 3 months, but by that time their babies were already doing their nights. At first I figure that I'm just meeting a few lucky French parents, but soon the evidence becomes overwhelming. Having a baby who sleeps through the night early on seems to be the norm in France. Just as stories of terrible sleepers are easy to find among Americans, stories of spectacular sleepers are easy to find among the French. My neighbors suddenly seem less obnoxious. They weren't baiting me. They actually believed that a 2-month-old might already be doing her nights. French parents don't expect their babies to sleep well right after they're born, but by the time these broken nights start to seem unbearable, usually after 2 or 3 months, they usually end. Parents talk about night wake-ups as a short-term problem, not a chronic one. Everyone I speak to takes for granted that babies can and probably will do their nights by about 6 months, and often much sooner. Certain babies do their night at 6 weeks. Others need 4 months to find their rhythm, an article in Maman magazine says. Le sommeil, le rêve et l'enfant, sleep, dreams, and the child, a top-selling sleep guide says that between 3 and 6 months is going to sleep complete nights of 8 or 9 hours at a minimum. The parents will finally rediscover the pleasure of long, uninterrupted nights. There are exceptions, of course. That's why France has baby sleep books and pediatric sleep specialists. Some babies who do their nights at 2 months start waking again a few months later. I do hear about French kids who take a year to start doing their nights. But the truth is, over many years in France, I don't meet them. Marianne, the mother of a little girl who becomes one of Bean's close friends, says her baby boy did his nights at 6 months. That's the longest among any of my Parisian friends and acquaintances. Most of them are like Paul, another architect, who says that his 3.5-month-old son sleeps a full 12 hours from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. What's maddening is that while French parents can tell you exactly when their kids began sleeping through the night, they can't explain how this came about. They don't mention sleep training, Ferberizing, a sleep technique developed by Dr. Richard Ferber, or any other branded method. And they claim that they never let their babies cry for long periods. In fact, most French parents look a little queasy when I mention this practice. Speaking to older parents isn't much help either. A French publicist in her 50s, who goes to work in pencil skirts and stilettos, is shocked to learn that I have any baby sleep issues. "Can't you give her something to sleep? You know, some medicine or something like that?" she asks. At the very least, she says, I should leave the baby with someone and recover at a spa for a week or two. None of the younger French parents I meet either drug their kids to sleep or hide in a sauna. Most insist that their babies learn to sleep long stretches all by themselves. Stephanie, the tax inspector, claims she didn't have much to do with it. I think it's the child. He's the one who decides, she said. I hear the same idea from Fanny, 33, the publisher of a group of financial magazines. Fanny says that at around 3 months old, her son Antoine spontaneously dropped his 3 a.m. feedings and slept through the night. He decided to sleep, Fanny explains. I never forced anything. You give him food when he needs food. He just regulated it all by himself. Fanny's husband, Vincent, who's listening to our conversation, points out that 3 months is exactly when Fanny went back to work. Like other French parents I speak to, he says this timing isn't a coincidence. He says Antoine understood that his mother needed to wake up early to go to the office. Vincent compares this understanding to the way ants communicate through chemical waves that pass between their antennae. We believe a lot in le feeling, Vincent says, using the English word. We guess that children understand things. French parents do offer a few sleep tips. They almost all say that in the early months, they kept their babies with them in the light during the day, even for naps, and put them to bed in the dark at night. And almost all say that, from birth, they carefully observed their babies and then followed the baby's own rhythms. French parents talk so much about rhythm. You'd think they were starting rock bands, not raising kids. From 0 to 6 months, the best is to respect the rhythms of their sleep, explains Alexandra, the mother whose baby slept through the night practically from birth. I observe Bean, too, often at 3 a.m.
So why is there no rhythm in our house? If sleeping through the night just happens, why hasn't it just happened to us? When I pour out my frustration to Gabrielle, one of my new French acquaintances, she recommends that I look at a book called L'Enfant et son Sommeil, The Child and His Sleep. She says the author, Hélène Delire-Snyder, is a well-known pediatrician in Paris who specializes in sleep. The book is baffling. I'm used to the straightforward self-help style of American baby books. Delire-Snyder's book opens with a quotation from Marcel Proust, then launches into an ode to slumber. Sleep reveals the child and the life of the family. Delire-Snyder writes, to go to bed and fall asleep, to separate himself from his parents for a few hours, the child must trust his body to keep him alive, even when he's not in control of it. And he must be serene enough to approach the strangeness of pensées de la nuit, thoughts that come in the night. Sleep Dreams and the Child also says that a baby can only sleep well once he accepts his own separateness. The discovery of peaceful, long, and serene nights, and an acceptance of solitude, is that not a sign that the child has recovered his inner peace, that he has moved beyond sorrow? Even the scientific sections of these books sound existential. What we call rapid eye movement sleep, the French call sommeil paradoxal, paradoxical sleep, because the body is still, but the mind is extremely active. To learn to sleep, to learn to live, are these not synonyms? Delire-Snyder asks. I'm still not sure what I'm supposed to do with this information. I'm not looking for a meta-theory on how to think about Bean's nights. I just want her to sleep. How can I figure out why French babies sleep so well if their own parents can't explain it and their sleep books read like cryptic poetry? What does a mother have to do for a good night's rest? Oddly enough, my epiphany about the French sleep rules happens while I'm visiting New York. I've come to the United States to visit family and friends, and also to get a hands-on feel for one corner of American parenting. For part of the trip, I stay in Tribeca, the neighborhood in Lower Manhattan where industrial buildings have been converted into Tony loft apartments. I hang out at a local playground, chatting with the other mothers. I thought I knew my parenting literature, but these women make it clear that I'm just a dilettante. Not only have they read everything, they've also assembled their own parenting styles, like eclectic designer outfits, following separate gurus for sleep, discipline, and food. When I naively mention attachment parenting to one Tribeca mother, she immediately corrects me. I don't like that term because who's not attached to their child, she says. When talk turns to how their kids sleep, I expect these women to cite lots of theories, then to give the usual American complaints about one-year-olds waking up twice per night. But they don't. Instead, they say that lots of babies in Tribeca do their nights à la française at about 2 months old. One mother, a photographer, mentions that she and many others bring their kids to a local pediatrician named Michel Cohen. She pronounces his first name Michel, like the Beatles song. Is he French? I venture. Yeah, she says. French from France? I ask. French from France, she says. I immediately make an appointment to meet Cohen. When I walk into his waiting room, there's no doubt that I'm in Tribeca and not in Paris. There's an Eames lounge chair, retro 70s wallpaper, and a lesbian mother in a fedora. A receptionist in a black tank top is calling out the names of the next patients. Ella? Benjamin? When Cohen comes out, I immediately see why he's such a hit with mothers. He has tousled brown hair, doe-like eyes, and a deep tan. He wears his designer shirts untucked, with sandals and Bermuda shorts. Despite 2 decades in the United States, he has hung on to a charming French accent and parlance.
When I give my advices to parents, ...
He's done for the day, so he suggests that we sit outside at a local cafe. I readily agree. Cohen clearly loves America, in part because America venerates its mavericks and entrepreneurs. In the land of managed care, he's fashioned himself into a neighborhood doctor. He greets a dozen passerbys by name as we sip our beers. His practice, Tribeca Pediatrics, has expanded to 5 locations, and he's published a pithy parenting book called The New Basics, with his picture on the cover. Cohen is reluctant to credit France for the innovations he's brought to Lower Manhattan. He left France in the late 1980s and remembers it as a country where newborn babies were left to cry it out in the hospital. Even now, he says,
"You can't go to a park without seeing a kid take a beating."
Perhaps this used to be true. However, in the scores of hours I've clocked in Parisian parks recently, I witnessed a spanking only once. But some of Cohen's advices are exactly what today's Parisian parents do. Like the French, he starts babies off on vegetables and fruits rather than bland cereals. He's not obsessed with allergies. He talks about rhythm and teaching kids to handle frustration. He values calm, and he gives real weight to the parents' own quality of life, not just to the child's welfare. So how does Cohen get the babies of Tribeca to do their nights?
"My first intervention is to say, when your baby is born, just don't jump on your kid at night," Cohen says. "Give your baby a chance to self-soothe. Don't automatically respond, even from birth."
Maybe it's the beer or Cohen's doe eyes, but I get a little jolt when he says this. I realize that I've seen French mothers and nannies pausing exactly this little bit before tending to their babies during the day. It hadn't occurred to me that this was deliberate, or that it was at all significant. In fact, it had bothered me. I didn't think that you were supposed to make babies wait. Could this explain why French babies do their nights so early on, supposedly with few tears? Cohen's advice to pause a little bit does seem like a natural extension of observing a baby. A mother isn't strictly observing if she jumps up and holds the baby the moment he cries. For Cohen, this pause, I'm tempted to call it la pause, is crucial. He says that using it very early on makes a big difference in how babies sleep.
"The parents who were a little less responsive to late-night fussing always had kids who were good sleepers, while the jumpy folks had kids who would wake up repeatedly at night until it became unbearable," he writes.
Most of the babies Cohen sees are breastfed. That doesn't seem to make a difference. One reason for pausing is that young babies make a lot of movements and noise while they're sleeping. This is normal and fine. If parents rush in and pick the baby up every time he makes a peep, they'll sometimes wake him up. Another reason for pausing is that babies wake up between their sleep cycles, which last about 2 hours. It's normal for them to cry a bit when they're first learning to connect these cycles. If a parent automatically interprets this cry as a demand for food or a sign of distress and rushes in to soothe the baby will have a hard time learning to connect the cycles on his own. That is, he'll need an adult to come in and soothe him back to sleep at the end of each cycle. Newborns typically can't connect sleep cycles on their own, but from about 2 or 3 months they usually can, if given a chance to learn how. And according to Cohen, connecting sleep cycles is like riding a bike. If a baby manages to fall back to sleep on his own even once, he'll have an easier time doing it again the next time. Adults wake up between their sleep cycles too, but typically don't remember this because they've learned to plunge right into the next one. Cohen says that sometimes babies do need to be fed or picked up, but unless we pause and observe them, we can't be sure.
"Of course, if the baby's requests become more persistent, you have to feed her," Cohen writes. "I'm not saying let your baby wail."
What he's saying is, just give your baby a chance to learn. This idea isn't entirely new to me. It sounds familiar from some of my American sleep books, but it's usually mentioned among lots of other advice. I may have tried it once or twice with Bean, but never with particular conviction. No one ever pointed it out to me as the one crucial, most important thing to do and to stick with. Cohen's singular instruction could solve the mystery of why French parents claim they never let their babies cry for long periods. If parents do the pause in a baby's first 2 months, the baby can learn to fall back to sleep on his own, so his parents won't need to resort to crying it out later on. The pause doesn't have the brutal feeling of sleep training. It's more like sleep teaching, but the window for it is pretty small. According to Cohen, it's only until the baby is 4 months old. After that, bad sleep habits are formed. Cohen says his sleep methods are an easy sell for the results-oriented parents in his Tribeca practice, but elsewhere, he says, parents often need more coaxing. They're opposed to letting their babies cry even a little. Cohen says he eventually persuades almost all the parents of newborns in his practice to try his methods.
I try to explain the roots of things, he says.
That is, he teaches them about sleep. When I get back to Paris, I immediately ask French mothers whether they do the pause. Every single one says that, yes, of course they do. They say this is so obvious they hadn't thought to mention it. Most say they started doing the pause when their babies were a few weeks old. Alexandra, whose daughters slept through the night while they were still in the hospital, says that of course she didn't rush over to them the second they cried. She sometimes waited 5 or 10 minutes before picking them up. She wanted to see whether they needed to fall back to sleep between sleep cycles, or whether something else was bothering them. Hunger, a dirty diaper, or just anxiety. Alexandra, who wears her curly blonde hair in a ponytail, looks like a cross between an Earth mother and a high school cheerleader. She's extremely warm. She wasn't ignoring her newborn babies. To the contrary, she was carefully observing them. She trusted that when they cried, they were telling her something. During the pause, she watched and listened. She adds that there's another reason for the pause: to teach them patience. French parents don't have a name for the pause. They just consider it common sense. It's the American in me who needs to brand it. But they all seem to do it, and to remind each other that it's critical. It's such a simple thing. It strikes me that the French genius isn't coming up with a novel, mind-blowing sleep trick. It's clearing out the clutter of competing ideas and focusing on one thing that truly makes a difference. Now that I'm attuned to the pause, I start to notice that it's mentioned a lot in France.
Before responding to an interrogation, common sense tells us to listen to the question,
says an article on Doctissimo, a popular French website.
It's exactly the same thing with a crying baby. The first thing to do is to listen to him.
Once you get past the philosophical sections, the authors of Sleep, Dreams, and the Child write that intervening between sleep cycles indisputably leads to sleep problems, such as a baby who fully wakes up after every 90-minute or 2-hour cycle. It's suddenly clear to me that Allison, the marketing expert whose son fed every 2 hours for 6 months, wasn't handed a baby with weird sleep needs. She unwittingly taught him to need a feed at the end of every 2-hour sleep cycle. Allison wasn't just catering to her son's demands. Despite her best intentions, she was creating those demands. I never hear of a single case like Allison's in France. The French treat the pause as sleep solution number one, and something to wheel out when the baby is only a few weeks old. An article in Maman magazine points out that in the first 6 months of a baby's life, 50% to 60% of his sleep is sommeil agité, agitated sleep. In this state, a sleeping baby suddenly yawns, stretches, and even opens and closes his eyes.
The error would be to interpret this as a call and thus derail a baby's sleep train by picking him up, the article says.
The pause isn't the only thing that French parents do, but it's a critical ingredient. When I visit Hélène Delire-Snider, the Proust-quoting sleep doctor, she immediately mentions the pause, without any prompting.
Sometimes when babies sleep, their eyes move. They make noise, they suck, they move around a bit. But in reality, they're sleeping, so you mustn't go in all the time and disturb him while he's sleeping. You have to learn how the baby sleeps.
What if he wakes up? I ask.
If he wakes up completely, you pick him up, of course.
When I talk to American parents about sleep, science rarely comes up. Faced with so many different and seemingly valid sleep philosophies, the one they ultimately choose seems like a matter of taste. But once I get French parents talking, they mention sleep cycles, circadian rhythms, and sommeil paradoxal. They know that one reason babies cry in the night is that they're in between sleep cycles, or they're in sommeil agité. When these parents said that they observed their babies, they meant that they were training themselves to recognize these stages. When French parents pause, they do it consistently and confidently. They're making informed decisions based on their understanding of how babies sleep. Behind this is an important philosophical difference. French parents believe it's their job to gently teach babies how to sleep well, the same way they'll later teach them how to have good hygiene, eat balanced meals, and ride a bike. They don't view being up half the night with an 8-month-old as a sign of parental commitment. They view it as a sign that the child has a sleep problem and that his family is wildly out of balance. When I describe Allison's case to French women, they say it's impossible, both for the child and for his mother. The French believe, as we do, that their children are beautiful and special, but they also realize that some things about them are just biological. Before we assume that our own children sleep like no others, we should probably think about science. Armed with my revelation about the pause, I decide to look at some of the scientific literature on babies and sleep. What I find shocks me. American parents may be fighting the baby sleep wars, but American sleep researchers aren't. The researchers mostly agree about the best way to get kids to sleep, and their recommendations sound remarkably French. Sleep researchers, like French parents, believe that beginning very early on, parents should play an active role in teaching their babies to sleep well. They say it's possible to begin teaching a healthy baby to sleep through the night when he's just a few weeks old, without the baby ever crying it out. A meta-study of dozens of peer-reviewed sleep papers concludes that what's critical is something called parent education prevention. This involves teaching pregnant women and parents of newborns about the science of sleep and giving them a few basic sleep rules. Parents are supposed to start following these rules from birth or when their babies are just a few weeks old. What are these rules? The authors of the meta-study point to a paper that tracked pregnant women who planned to breastfeed. Researchers gave some of the women a 2-page handout with instructions. One rule on the handout was that parents should not hold, rock, or nurse a baby to sleep in the evenings in order to help him learn the difference between day and night. Another instruction for week-old babies was that if they cried between midnight and 5 a.m., parents should re-swaddle, pat, re-diaper, or walk the baby around, but that the mother should offer the breast only if the baby continued crying after that. An additional instruction was that, from the child's birth, the mother should distinguish between when their babies were crying and when they were just whimpering in their sleep. In other words, before picking up a noisy baby, the mother should pause to make sure he's awake. The researchers explained the scientific basis for these instructions. A control group of breastfeeding mothers had gotten no instructions. The results were remarkable. From birth to 3 weeks old, babies in the treatment and control groups had nearly identical sleep patterns, but at 4 weeks old, 38% of the treatment group babies were sleeping through the night versus 7% of the control group babies. At 8 weeks, all of the treatment babies were sleeping through the night compared with 23% of the control babies. The author's conclusion is resounding. The results of this study show that breastfeeding need not be associated with night waking. The pause isn't just some French folk wisdom. Neither is the belief that sleeping well early on is better for everyone. In general, night wakings fall within the diagnostic category of behavioral insomnia of childhood, the meta-study explains. The study says there's growing evidence that young children who don't sleep enough or who have disturbed sleep can suffer from irritability, aggressiveness, hyperactivity, and poor impulse control, and can have trouble learning and remembering things. They are more prone to accidents, their metabolic and immune functions are weakened, and their overall quality of life diminishes. And sleep problems that begin in infancy can persist for many years. In the study of breastfeeding mothers, the treatment group infants were afterward rated more secure, more predictable, and less fussy. The studies I read point out that when children sleep badly, there's spillover to the rest of the family, including maternal depression and lower overall family functioning. Conversely, when babies slept better, their parents reported that their marriages improved and that they became better and less stressed parents. Of course, some French babies miss the 4-month window for sleep teaching. When this happens, French experts usually recommend some version of crying it out. Sleep researchers aren't ambivalent about this either. The meta study found that letting kids cry it out, either by going cold turkey, known by the unfortunate scientific term extinction, or in stages, graduated extinction, works extremely well and usually succeeds in just a few days. The biggest obstacle associated with extinction is lack of parental consistency, the study says. Michelle Cohen, the French doctor in Tribeca, recommends a rather extreme version of this for parents who miss the 4-month window. He says they should make the baby feel cozy with his usual nighttime bath and songs. Then they should put him in bed at a reasonable hour, preferably while he's still awake, and come back at 7 a.m. In Paris, crying it out has a French twist. I start to realize this when I meet Laurence, a nanny from Normandy, who's working for a French family in Montparnasse. Laurence has been looking after babies for 2 decades. She tells me that before letting a baby cry it out, it's crucial to explain to him what you're about to do. Laurence walks me through this. In the evening, you speak to him. You tell him that if he wakes up once, you're going to give him his pacifier once. But after that, you're not going to get up. It's time to sleep. You're not far away, and you're going to come in and reassure him once, but not all night long. Laurence adds that a crucial part of getting a baby to do his nights at any age is to truly believe that he's going to do it. If you don't believe it, it's not going to work, she says. Me, I always think that the child is going to sleep better the next night. I always have hope. Even if he wakes up 3 hours later, you have to believe. It does seem possible that French babies rise to meet their parents' and caregivers' expectations. Perhaps we all get the sleepers we expect, and the simple fact of believing that babies have a rhythm helps us to find it. To believe in the pause, or in letting an older baby cry it out, you also have to believe that a baby is a person who's capable of learning things, in this case, how to sleep, and coping with some frustration. Michelle Cohen spends a lot of time converting parents to this French idea. To the common worry that a 4-month-old is hungry at night, he writes, "She is hungry, but she does not need to eat. You're hungry in the middle of the night, too. It's just that you learn not to eat because it's good for your belly to take a rest. Well, it's good for us, too." The French don't believe that babies should withstand biblical-sized trials, but they also don't think that a bit of frustration will crush kids. To the contrary, they believe it will make children more secure. According to Sleep, Dreams, and the Child, to always respond to his demands and never tell him no is dangerous for the construction of his personality, because the child won't have any barrier to push up against to know what's expected of him. For the French, teaching a small baby to sleep isn't a self-serving strategy for lazy parents. It's a crucial first lesson for children in self-reliance and enjoying one's own company. A psychologist quoted in Maman magazine says that babies who learn to play by themselves during the day, even in the first few months, are less worried when they're put into their beds alone at night. Delia Snider writes that even babies need some privacy. The little baby learns in his cradle that he can be alone from time to time, without being hungry, without being thirsty, without sleeping, just being calmly awake. At a very young age, he needs time alone, and he needs to go to sleep and wake up without being immediately watched by his mother. Delia Sneider even devotes a portion of her book to what a mother should do while her baby sleeps. She forgets about her baby to think about herself. She now takes her own shower, gets dressed, puts on makeup, becomes beautiful for her own pleasure, that of her husband and of others. Evening comes, and she prepares herself for the night, for love. As an American parent, this film noir scene, with its suggestion of coal eyeliner and silk stockings, is hard to imagine in anything but the movies. Simon and I just assumed that, for quite a while, we'd rearrange our lives around Bean's whims. The French don't think that's good for anyone. They view learning to sleep as part of learning to be part of the family and adapting to what other members of the family need, too. Delia Sneider tells me, if he wakes up 10 times at night, the mother can't go to work the next day. So that makes the baby understand that, voila, he can't wake up 10 times a night. The baby understands that? I ask. Of course he understands that, she says. How can he understand that? Because babies understand everything. French parents think the pause is essential, but they don't hold it up as a panacea. Instead, they have a bundle of beliefs and habits, which, when applied patiently and lovingly, put babies in the mood to sleep well. The pause works in part because parents believe that tiny babies aren't helpless blobs. They can learn things. This learning, done gently and at a baby's own pace, isn't damaging. To the contrary, parents believe it gives the babies confidence and serenity and makes them aware of other people. And it sets the tone for the respectful relationship between parents and children that I see later on. If only I had known all this when Bean was born. We definitely miss the 4-month window for painlessly teaching her to sleep through the night. At 9 months old, she still wakes up every night at around 2 a.m. So we brace ourselves to let her cry it out. On the first night, she cries for 12 minutes. I clutch Simon and cry too. Then she goes back to sleep. The next night, she cries for 5 minutes. On the third night, Simon and I both wake up to silence at 2 a.m. I think she was waking up for us, Simon says. She thought that we needed her to do it. Then we go back to sleep. Bean has been doing her nights ever since. Chapter 4. Wait. I'm getting more used to living in France. After a march around the local parks one morning, I announced to Simon that we've finally joined the global elite. We're global, but we're not elite, he replies. Though I've made some inroads in France, I miss the United States. I miss grocery shopping in sweatpants, smiling at strangers, and being able to banter. Mostly, I miss my parents. I can't believe I'm raising a child while they're 4,500 miles away. Neither can my mother. My meeting and marrying a handsome foreigner was the thing she most dreaded when I was growing up. She discussed this fear so extensively that it's probably what planted the idea. On one visit to Paris, she takes me and Simon out to dinner and breaks down in tears at the table. What do they have here that they don't have in America? She demands to know. Had she been eating escargot, I could have pointed at her plate. Unfortunately, she had ordered the chicken. Although living in France has gotten easier, I haven't really assimilated. To the contrary, having a baby and speaking better French makes me realize just how foreign I am. Soon after Bean begins sleeping through the night, we arrive for her first day at France's state-run daycare center, called the Creche. During the intake interview, we sail through questions about her pacifier use and favorite sleeping positions. We're ready with her inoculation records and emergency contact numbers. But one question stumps us. What time does she have her milk? On the matter of when to feed babies, American parents are once again in sparring camps. You could call it a food fight. One camp believes in feeding babies at fixed times. Another says to feed them whenever they seem hungry. The American website Baby Center gives 8 different sample schedules for 5- and 6-month-olds, including one in which the baby eats 10 times a day. We've drifted into a hybrid. Bean always has milk when she wakes up and again before bedtime. In between, we feed her whenever she seems hungry. Simon thinks there isn't a problem that a bottle or a boob can't solve. We'll both do anything to keep her from yowling. When I finish explaining our feeding system to the creche lady, she looks at me like I've just said that we let our baby drive the family car. We don't know when our child eats. This is a problem she will soon solve. Her look says that while we're living in Paris, we're raising a child who eats and sleeps, and yes, probably poops like an American. The creche lady's look also reveals that on this too, there are no sparring camps in France. Parents don't anguish about how often their children should eat. From the age of about 4 months, most French babies eat at regular times. As with sleep techniques, French parents see this as common sense, not as part of a parenting philosophy. What's even stranger is that these French babies all eat at roughly the same times. With slight variations, mothers tell me that their babies eat at about 8 a.m., 12 p.m., 4 p.m., and 8 p.m. Votre Enfant, a respected French parenting guide, has just one sample menu for 4- or 5-month-olds. It's this same sequence of feeds. In French, these aren't even called feeds, which, after all, sounds like you're pitching hay to cows. They're called meals, and their sequence resembles a schedule I'm quite familiar with: breakfast, lunch, and dinner, plus an afternoon snack. In other words, by about 4 months old, French babies are already on the same eating schedule that they'll be on for the rest of their lives. Grown-ups usually drop the snack. You'd think the existence of this national baby meal plan would be obvious. Instead, it feels like a state secret. If you merely ask French parents if their babies eat on a schedule, they almost always say no. As with sleep, they insist that they're merely following their baby's rhythms. When I point out that French babies all seem to eat at roughly the same times, parents shrug this off as a coincidence. The deeper mystery to me is how all these French babies are capable of waiting 4 hours from one meal to the next. Bean gets anxious if she has to wait even a few minutes for a feed. We get anxious, too. But I'm beginning to sense that there's a lot of waiting going on all around me in France. First, there was the pause, in which French parents wait after their baby wakes up. Now there's the baby meal plan, in which they wait long stretches from one feeding to the next. And of course, there are all those toddlers waiting contentedly in restaurants until their food arrives. The French seem collectively to have achieved the miracle of getting babies and toddlers not just to wait, but to do so happily. Could this ability explain the difference between French and American kids? To get my head around these questions, I email Walter Michel, the world's expert on how children delay gratification. He's 80 years old and a chaired professor of psychology at Columbia University. I read all about him and read some of his many published papers on the topic. I explain that I'm in Paris researching French parenting and ask if he might have time to speak with me on the phone. Michel replies a few hours later. To my surprise, he says that he's in Paris, too. Would I like to come by for a coffee? 2 days later, we're at the kitchen table in his girlfriend's apartment in the Latin Quarter, just down the hill from the Pantheon. Michel hardly looks 70, and certainly not 80. He has a shaved head and the coiled energy of a boxer, but with a sweet, almost childlike face. It's not hard to envision him as the 8-year-old boy from Vienna who fled Austria with his family after the Nazis annexed the country. The family eventually landed in Brooklyn. When Walter entered public school at age 9, he was assigned to kindergarten to learn English and remembers trying to walk on my knees to not stick out from the 5-year-olds when our class marched through the corridors. Michel's parents, who were cultured and comfortably middle class in Vienna, opened a struggling 5 and dime. His mother, who'd been a minor depressive in Vienna, was energized by America, but his father never recovered from his fall in status. This early experience gave Michel a permanent outsider's perspective and helped frame the questions that he has spent his career answering. In his 30s, he upended the science of personality by arguing that people's traits aren't fixed. They depend on context. Despite marrying an American and raising their 3 daughters in California, Michel began making annual pilgrimages to Paris.
I always felt myself to be European and felt Paris was the capital of Europe, he tells me.
Michel, who divorced in 1996, has lived with a French woman for the last decade. They divide their time between New York and Paris. Michel is most famous for devising the marshmallow test in the late 1960s when he was at Stanford. In it, an experimenter leads a 4 or 5-year-old into a room where there's a marshmallow on a table. The experimenter tells the child he's going to leave the room for a little while. If the child manages not to eat the marshmallow until he comes back, he'll be rewarded with 2 marshmallows. If he eats the marshmallow, he'll get only that one. It's a very hard test. Of the 653 kids who took it back in the 60s and 70s, only 1 in 3 managed to resist eating the marshmallow for the full 15 minutes that the experimenter was away. Some ate it as soon as they were alone. Most could wait only about 30 seconds. In the mid-1980s, Michel revisited the kids from the original experiment to see if there was a difference between how good and bad delayers were faring as teenagers. He and his colleagues found a remarkable correlation. The longer the children had resisted eating the marshmallow as 4-year-olds, the higher Michel and his colleagues assessed them in all sorts of other categories later on. Among other skills, the good delayers were better at concentrating and reasoning, and according to a report that Michel and his colleagues published in 1988, they do not tend to go to pieces under stress. Could it be that making children delay gratification, as middle-class French parents do, actually makes them calmer and more resilient? Whereas middle-class American kids, who are in general more used to getting what they want right away, go to pieces under stress. Are French parents once again doing, by tradition and instinct, exactly what scientists like Michel recommend? Bean, who usually gets what she wants almost immediately, can go from calm to hysterical in seconds. And whenever I go back to America, I realize that miserable, screaming toddlers demanding to get out of their strollers or pitching themselves onto the sidewalk are part of the scenery of daily life. I rarely see such scenes in Paris. French babies and toddlers, who are used to waiting longer, seem oddly calm about not getting what they want right away. When I visit French families and hang out with their kids, there's a conspicuous lack of whining and complaining. Often, or at least much more often than in my house, everyone's calm and absorbed in what they're doing. In France, I regularly see what amounts to a minor miracle. Adults in the company of small children at home having entire cups of coffee and full-length adult conversations. Waiting is even part of the parenting vernacular. Instead of saying, quiet or stop to rowdy kids, French parents often just issue a sharp attends, which means wait. Michel hasn't performed the marshmallow test on any French children. He'd probably have to do a version with pain au chocolat. But as a longtime observer of France, he says he's struck by the difference between French and American kids. In America, he says, certainly the impression one has is that self-control has gotten increasingly difficult for kids. That's sometimes true even with his own grandchildren. I don't like it when I call a daughter if she tells me that she can't talk now because a child is pulling on her and she can't say, hold on, I'm talking to Papa. Having kids who can wait makes family life more pleasant. Children in France seem much more disciplined and more raised the way I was, Michel says. With French friends coming over with small children, you can still have a French dinner. The expectation with French kids is that they'll behave themselves in an appropriate, quiet way and enjoy the dinner. Enjoy is an important word here. For the most part, French parents don't expect their kids to be mute, joyless, and compliant. Parents just don't see how their kids can enjoy themselves if they can't control themselves. I often hear French parents telling their kids to be sage. In French, sage rhymes with the Taj in Taj Mahal. Saying, sois sage, is a bit like saying, be good. But it implies more than that. When I tell Bean to be good before we walk into someone's house, it's as if she's a wild animal who must act tame for an hour, but who could turn wild again at any moment. It implies that being good goes contrary to her true nature. When I tell Bean to be sage, I'm also telling her to behave appropriately, but I'm asking her to use good judgment and to be aware and respectful of other people. I'm implying that she has a certain wisdom about the situation and that she's in command of herself, and I'm suggesting that I trust her. Being sage doesn't mean being dull. The French kids I know have a lot of fun. On weekends, Bean and her friends run shouting and laughing through the park for hours. Recess at her daycare and later at her school are free-for-alls. There's also a lot of organized fun in Paris, like children's film festivals, theaters, and cooking classes, which require patience and attention. The French parents I know want their kids to have rich experiences and to be exposed to art and music. Parents just don't see how kids can fully absorb these experiences if they don't have patience. In the French view, having the self-control to be calmly present, rather than anxious, irritable, and demanding, is what allows kids to have fun. French parents and caregivers don't think that kids have infinite patience. They don't expect toddlers to sit through symphonies or formal banquets. They usually talk about waiting in terms of minutes or seconds. But even these small delays seem to make a big difference. I'm now convinced that the secret of why French kids rarely whine or collapse into tantrums, or at least do so less than American kids, is that they've developed the internal resources to cope with frustration. They don't expect to get what they want instantly. When French parents talk about the education of their children, they are talking, in large part, about teaching them how not to eat the marshmallow. So how exactly do the French turn ordinary children into expert delayers? And can we teach Bean how to wait, too? Walter Michel watched videotapes of hundreds of squirming four-year-olds taking the marshmallow test. He eventually figured out that the bad delayers focused on the marshmallow, whereas the good delayers distracted themselves. The kids who manage to wait very easily are the ones who learn during the wait to sing little songs to themselves, or pick their ears in an interesting way, or play with their toes and make a game of it, he tells me. The ones who didn't know how to distract themselves and just fixated on the marshmallow ended up eating it. Michel concludes that having the willpower to wait isn't about being stoic. It's about learning techniques that make waiting less frustrating. There are many ways of doing that, of which the most direct and the simplest is to self-distract, he says. Parents don't have to specifically teach their kids distraction strategies. Michel says kids learn this skill on their own if parents just allow them to practice waiting. I think what's often underestimated in parenting is how extraordinary the cognitive facilities of very young kids are, if you engage them, he says. This is exactly what I've been seeing French parents doing. They don't explicitly teach their kids distraction techniques. Mostly, they just seem to give them lots of opportunities to practice waiting. On a gray Saturday afternoon, I take a commuter train to Fontenay-sous-Bois, a suburb just east of Paris. A friend has arranged for me to visit a family that lives there. Martine, the mother, is a pretty labor lawyer in her mid-30s. She lives with her husband, an emergency room doctor, and their two kids in a modern low-rise building set amid a patch of trees. I'm immediately struck by how much Martine's apartment resembles my own. Toys line the perimeter of the living room, which is attached to an open kitchen, known in French as a cuisine américaine. We have the same stainless steel appliances. But the similarities end there. Despite having two young kids, Martine's house has a calm that we could only wish for. When I arrive, her husband is working on his laptop in the living room, while one-year-old Auguste naps nearby. Paulette, their three-year-old with a pixie haircut, is sitting at the kitchen table plopping cupcake batter into little wrappers. When each wrapper is full, She tops it with colored sprinkles and fresh red gooseberries. Martine and I sit down to chat at the other end of the table, but I'm transfixed by little Paulette and her cupcakes. Paulette is completely absorbed in her task. She somehow resists the temptation to eat the batter. When she's done, she asks her mother if she can lick the spoon.
No, but you can have some sprinkles, Martine says, prompting Paulette to shake out several tablespoons of sprinkles onto the table.
My daughter Bean is the same age as Paulette, but it wouldn't have occurred to me to let her do a complicated task like this all on her own. I'd be supervising, and she'd be resisting my supervision. There would be much stress and whining, mine and hers. Bean would probably grab batter, berries, and sprinkles each time I turned around. I certainly wouldn't be chatting calmly with a visitor. The whole scene wouldn't be something I'd want to repeat a week later. Yet baking seems to be a weekly ritual in France. Practically every time I visit a French family on a weekend, they're either making a cake or serving the one they made earlier that day. At first, I think this must be because I'm visiting, but I soon realize that it has nothing to do with me. There's a national bake-off in Paris every weekend. Practically from the time kids can sit up, their moms begin leading them in weekly or bi-weekly baking projects. These kids don't just spill some flour and mash a few bananas. They crack eggs, pour in cups of sugar, and mix with preternatural confidence. They actually make the whole cake themselves. The first cake that most French kids learn to bake is gâteau au yaourt, yogurt cake, in which they use empty yogurt containers to measure out the other ingredients. It's a light, not too sweet cake to which berries, chocolate chips, lemon, or a tablespoon of rum can be added. It's pretty hard to screw up. All this baking doesn't just yield lots of cakes. It also teaches kids how to control themselves. With its orderly measuring and sequencing of ingredients, baking is a perfect lesson in patience. So is the fact that French families don't devour the cake as soon as it comes out of the oven, as I would. They typically bake in the morning or early afternoon, then wait, and eat the cake or muffins as a goûter, the French afternoon snack.